Michael Shermer is founding publisher of Skeptic Magazine, writes for Scientific American.
Yeah, I do.
Was a college professor, still teaches some stuff at Claremont Graduate University. His most recent book is The Mind of the Market.
All right, thank you, Roger, and Rob Zepps and the Zepps family for sponsoring this and bringing me in. This is my third Beyond Belief, so there's been three. I guess that makes it a streak. At the first two, we talked a lot about religion, and I'm mostly a science activist, although I've been drawn into this. I guess it's a little bit like crossing an atheist with a Jehovah's Witness, is somebody who knocks on your door for no reason at all, and I seem to be doing a lot of that lately. At any rate, the general consensus seemed to be here in the first two that that religion is a serious problem. In fact, there was this idea that if we could just get rid of religion and the delusion of believing in God, that that would eliminate most wars and revolutions and conflicts and intolerance and bigotry and the like, the imagine no religion scenario. And I think that's just a bit too easy, a little simplified. I think in most instances, religion tends to be an excuse for land-grabbing, power-mongering, political machinations, economic manipulations. I think you can remove the excuse, and another one would quickly fill the void. So Marxism, for example, is a 20th century faux religion, which does just as effective a job as religion does. As well, more recently, nationalism, both political nationalism and economic nationalism, I think, is just as dangerous. So I think the problem is not religion, the problem is tribalism. We're a social primate species, and as such, we're exceptionally tribal. Group identity is essential to our sense of self, and although, yes, there's religious tribalism, there's economic and political tribalism, and the unfortunate byproduct of this is that we are pretty xenophobic. We have a natural aversion to others, and we show a remarkable ability to sort people into in-group, out-group categories on practically any criteria. The Crips and the Bloods, the Hutus and the Tutsis, the Albanians and the Serbs, the Shiites and the Sunnis, or more recently and closer to home, the conservatives and the liberals. So the tropes are pretty familiar. Conservatives, as you know, are stingy, heartless, dour, dim-witted authoritarians who appeal to voters' emotions through threat and fear-mongering. Conservatives, we're told, they avoid uncertainty. They have a need for order, structure, and closure. Conservatives are resistant to change, and they endorse inequalities. Of course, conservatives know all about liberals. Liberals are a bunch of sandal-wearing, tree-hugging, whale-saving, hybrid-driving, trash-recycling, peacenik, flip-flopping bedwetters. Liberals, say conservatives, lack a moral compass that leads to an inability to make clear ethical choices. And they have an inordinate lack of certainty about many social issues. Liberals have a pathological fear of clarity that leads to indecisiveness, a naive belief that most people, virtually all people, are equally talented, and a blind adherence in the teeth of contradictory evidence that culture and environment determines one's lots in society, and therefore it's up to the government to remedy all social injustices. Pace Richard Dawkins, I call this the government delusion. So anyway, I think we can move beyond such obvious oversimplifications of both liberals and conservatives. And I think we should adopt the approach that considers liberals and conservatives as emphasizing different moral values. I wasn't here yesterday, so Jonathan, I don't know if you emphasize this, but I like Jonathan Haidt's approach that, quote, morality is not just about how we treat each other, as most liberals think. It is also about binding groups together, supporting essential institutions, and living in a sanctified and noble way. When Republicans say that Democrats just don't get it, that's the it to which they refer. So conservative positions on gays and guns and God must be understood as a means to achieve this kind of moral order in society. Anyway, I think ever since 9/11, it's become clear that other tribes are dangerous, really dangerous. They're not rational. You can't just sit down and reason with them. And I think that's a threat that conservatives understand, or at least take more seriously than liberals appear to. It reminds me a little bit of Rob Reiner's 1992 film, A Few Good Men, in which Jack Nicholson's character, the battle-hardened Marine Colonel Nathan R. Jessup, is being cross-examined by Tom Cruise's naive rookie Navy lawyer, Lieutenant Daniel Caffey. Caffey is defending two Marines accused of killing a fellow soldier named Santiago. He thinks Jessup ordered a code red, an off-the-books command to rough up a lazy Marine trainee in need of discipline, and that matters got tragically out of hand. Caffey wants answers to specific questions about the incident. Jessup wants to lecture him on the meaning of freedom and the need to defend it. The ensuing dialogue includes Jessup's penetrating testimony about the true nature of human nature.
Colonel Jessup, did you order the code red?
You don't have to answer that question.
I'll answer the question. You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth.
You can't handle the truth. Son, we live in a world that has walls, and those walls have to be guarded by men with guns. Who's going to do it? You, Lieutenant Weinberg? I have a greater responsibility than you can possibly fathom. You weep for Santiago, and you curse the Marines. You have that luxury. You have the luxury of not knowing what I know, that Santiago's death, while tragic, probably saved lives. And my existence, while grotesque and incomprehensible to you, saves lives. You don't want the truth because deep down in places you don't talk about at parties. You want me on that wall. You need me on that wall. We use words like honor, code, loyalty. We use these words as the backbone of a life spent defending something. You use them as a punchline. I have neither the time nor the inclination to explain myself to a man who rises and sleeps under the blanket of the very freedom that I provide and then questions the manner in which I provide it. I would rather you just said thank you and went on your way. Otherwise, I suggest you pick up a weapon and stand a post. Either way, I don't give a damn what you think you are entitled to.
Did you order the code red?
I did the job.
Did you order the code red?
You're goddamn right I did!
One of the great moments in movie history. So the simple observation that we live in a world with walls and have for 6,000 years of recorded history implies, obviously, the walls are needed. The constitutions of states have yet to alter the constitutions of man. So maybe we should try something different. I got to thinking about this type 1 civilization when I was, that is, what we can move toward that is somehow different from politics and economics, tribal politics and tribal economics as usual. In a 1964 article on searching for extraterrestrial intelligences, the Soviet astronomer Nikolai Kardashev suggested using radio telescopes to detect energy signals from other possible civilizations, and he typed them, just to different looking for different types. Like a type 1 civilization, for example, controls the energy of its sun. A type 2 civilization controls the energy of an entire planet star, and then a type 3 galactic civilization controls the energy of an entire galaxy. Presumably, the signals you would find would be different for these kinds of civilizations. And we're somewhere between a type 0 and a type 1. 1973, Sagan calculated we were about a 0.7 civilization, still burning dead plants and oil and coal as a primary energy source. So I got to thinking that we could kind of reconfigure the evolution of human culture using this typography, a type 1 being simply fission-fusion groups of primates, a 0.2 of bands of roaming hunter-gatherers that were pretty much of a horizontal political system and egalitarian economy, 0.3 tribes of individuals linked through kinship with a more settled and agrarian lifestyle, the beginnings of political hierarchy and a primitive economic division of labor, chiefdoms consisting of a coalition of tribes and bands into a single hierarchical political unit, a dominant leader at the top, the beginnings of significant economic inequalities and a division of labor in which lower class members produce food and other products consumed by non-producing upper class members. Type point 5, the state is a political coalition with jurisdiction over a well-defined geographical territory and its corresponding inhabitants with a mercantile economy that seeks a favorable balance of trade in a win-lose game against other states. Empires that extend their control over other people who are not culturally, ethnically, or geographically within their normal jurisdiction with a goal of economic dominance over rival empires. Point 7, democracies that divide power over several institutions which are run by elected officials voted for by some citizens in the beginnings of a market economy. Point 8, liberal democracies that grant the vote to all citizens. Markets that begin to embrace a non-zero win-win economic game through trade with other states, that is, more open, more porous economic borders with other states. What we might call, point 9, democratic capitalism, that is a blending of liberal democracy and free markets, now spreading across the globe through democratic movements in developing nations and broad trading blocks, like the European Union is an example of one of these broad trading blocks, a single currency that makes trade much more fluid and trust much more higher between trading partners. So a type 1 civilization, what would that look like? Something like having a harnessing all forms of energy on the planet, waves, wind, solar, nuclear, weather, earthquakes, hurricanes, volcanoes, and so forth. Perhaps colonizing mines and mining asteroids and colonizing moons. A type 1 civilization will have something like an international global phone system, like a wireless internet connections. And the movement then from point wherever we are, point 7, point 8, whatever our classification would be, toward a 1.0 would then look something like with free mines and free markets. So how do we make that shift? Well, obviously, energy-wise, the shift from fossil fuels to renewable energy, solar, wind, wave, geothermal, nuclear, and so on. A universal language, it looks like English is going to be that. It's already happening. The internet, already happening. Global culture, already happening. Music, youth culture, mass media. And then the last two that I'll wrap up with here. Global democracy, which a lot of other empires and states don't want. That's why we have so much resistance to the spread of global democracy. There's a lot of states that would still like to be at about a point 3 or point 4, just a nice theocracy with a big man at the top, and would rather not have multicultural progressive distributive power. And global free trade, for example, the European Union or NAFTA, and large trading blocks. These are steps toward global free trade, but the resistance is still pretty high there, even within America, where most intellectuals, non-economist intellectuals, think that we should still practice economic tribalism, protect American jobs, we shouldn't trade with this country or that country, we should impose economic sanctions on people we don't like, we should be worried about other empires that are economic powerhouses, that this is just plain old tribalism. It's just built into us, we can't help but doing it. So it requires some effort to get around that. We do know from research on this, people like Paul Zak look at this sort of thing, but economists and political scientists know that to get there, you need at least these characteristics, 12. There's, forgot to renumber the last one there. The rule of law, property rights, a secure and trustworthy banking and monetary system, as we've seen recently with, when you don't have that, what happens? Reliable infrastructure, freedom to move and travel, freedom of the press, freedom of association, protection of civil liberties, a clean and safe environment, a robust military for protection from attacks by other states, a potent police force for protection from attacks by people within your own state, a viable legislative system for establishing fair and just laws, and an effective judicial system for the equitable enforcement of those fair and just laws. So on the democracy thing, I'm just going to give a couple, instead of throwing up 27 slides, just two slides. All this is, most of this is in my book, The Mind of the Market, the data. The political scientist Rudy Rummel has researched this relationship between how much conflict there is between states that are democracies versus non-democracies. One study amongst many that he's published that of the 371 international wars that occurred between 1816 and 2005, in which at least 1,000 people were killed, there were 205 wars between non-democratic nations, 166 between democratic and non-democratic nations, and zero between democratic nations. Now, some of this data has been challenged. An obvious exception is the American Civil War. These are two democracies, so yeah, apparently he's not counting civil war, just war, conflict, or something like that. I'm not sure why he would not count that. But nevertheless, that is a first approximation principle. That is, are there some states that are better than other states in terms of reducing the amount of conflict between them? Yes, there is. Obviously, liberal democracies are better than other forms, even if they're not perfect. In terms of global economy and wealth, just one example amongst many. 2007 marked the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Treaty of Rome, in which France, Italy, Belgium, West Germany, Luxembourg, and the Netherlands formed what would eventually become the European Union by opening their borders to free trade and eventually getting a common currency that they could share and trade with. They moved from being about half as productive as the United States to being on an equal footing economically in only half that time. By comparison, Denmark, Ireland, and the United Kingdom were on economic par with those six countries before they signed the treaty, but they subsequently fell behind the six when Denmark, Ireland, and the UK opened their economic borders to trade with the original Treaty of Rome. Six, they eventually caught up with the UK today, for example, being as productive as Germany. So the principle there is open borders and free trade between peoples reduces the amount of normal xenophobic tribalism you would naturally feel toward other people, because it is a form of exchange that then produces oxytocin and dopamine and all the good stuff that happens in the brain there. And in any case, I actually elevated this to a principle in my book. This is Frederick Bastiat, the 19th century French economist, who said where goods do not cross frontiers, armies will. So the corollary to that then would be where goods cross frontiers, armies do not. Again, it's a first approximation. It's, you know, yes, there's exceptions. Thomas Friedman had a different version of this. He called his McDonald's theory of war, that where two countries have McDonald's in them, they don't fight. There's a few exceptions that, after his book came out, The World is Flat, people pointed out. But again, as a first approximation, as a principle that can apply, is this principle at least better than that principle? Absolutely. So I call this preference, because I don't like McDonald's. But pick any international chain, something like that. And then I'm just going to end by just reading from the final page from my book of the Starbucks corollary to Bastiat's principle, where Starbucks cross frontiers, armies will not. That is, the free trade of products between peoples and open access to services across geographic borders obviates the necessity of political borders and thereby decreases the probabilities that armies will cross them. To the Starbucks corollary, I added the Google theory of peace, where information and knowledge cross frontiers, armies will not. That is, the free trade of information between peoples and open access to knowledge across geographic borders obviates the necessity of political borders and thereby decreases the probability that armies will cross them. A stirring example can be seen in Europe. Since the Treaty of Rome and the formation of the European Union, which integrated disparate and historically divided European nations under one economic umbrella, where once invasions and wars were commonplace, in 1,000 years of European history, they're now virtually unthinkable. Try it. Imagine Germany invading France and waging war upon her. Or picture France motoring its armies through the Channel, marching them into London to declare the country. What once made for dramatic literature now sounds like pulp fiction. So the wickification of the economy. Here, Harry, I'm in agreement with you. So we were supposed to have it out this time, but I agree with your final comments there on YouTube and Google and so on, Wikipedia. In fact, I just call it the wickification of the economy. Wickonomics, as it's known, as adds to the Google theory of peace that the entire world economy, as practiced and participated in by billions of people, is a form of this wickification. It's the collaboratively created encyclopedia, as you know, that runs on wiki software. It's an open-sourced, peer-produced, mass-collaborated, bottom-up, self-organized, emergent property of millions of people choosing to build the modern equivalent of the Alexandrian Library, whose purpose it was to make the sum of the world's knowledge available to everyone in one location. Granted, the Alexandrian Greeks had far less knowledge to store than we have today, but we have the World Wide Web. In the long run, No dictator, demagogue, priest, president, or any other pretender to power will be able to control the Googlefication, Wikification, eBayification, MapQuestification, YouTubeification, MySpacification of information, knowledge, geography, personal relationships, markets, and the economy. Chinese bureaucrats can attempt to put all the firewalls and controls they want on a billion potential Chinese web surfers. But in the long run, they'll never be able to prevent knowledge, products, and people from finding their way to those who seek them. Freedom finds a way. Thank you.